5% raise last session, but I don't think I'm going to get that this year. Right. I think I'm going to vote yes on that.
The House Committee on Revenue for May 29, 2009 will come to order. We have one item on our agenda today. I don't seem to have an agenda, but we have one item on our agenda, which is the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 48. And we'll open that public hearing. Mazin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. This is 5:29, last day of May. And House Joint Resolution 48, it proposes the amendment into the Oregon Constitution to allow some form or level of taxation on carbon emissions and to use those taxes or the revenues from those taxes into some undefined, of course, now in the Constitution, but might be later on in statutes of this passes into a reduction of carbon programs. Now, of course, always the discussion that comes when you start talking about carbon and fuel and so on is the relationship between this constitutional amendment and what you would have with the other constitutional amendments of the highway dedication and the gas tax and so on. So I have in your background material in the SMS, the staff measure summary, in the background section, I put the constitutional citations that you would have with the highway fund, highway dedication for the gas tax, and that's where you can collect and how it is to be used. I've been also consulting and talking with Legislative Council, and this morning Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council, or Legislative Council, is here to head and start, if you would like, with questions about the differences and the relations between these existing clauses in the Constitution and proposed constitutional amendment.
Thank you. And I see that Representative Bailey is ready. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42 in Inner East Side, Portland. I want to thank you today for hearing House Joint Resolution 48. House Joint Resolution 48 is extremely simple. And I want to say at the outset, this resolution does not say whether we should impose carbon taxes, how much those carbon taxes should be, or if carbon taxes are the right way to achieve our climate future. What HJR 48 does is say that as we look to our transportation future and we look to our carbon future, if we are to choose to go down the route of a market-based mechanism that imposes a tax on fuel for carbon, that it is most efficient to be able to use that revenue to further mitigate carbon. Now, that sounds simple, but it clearly gets into an area, whenever we're talking about the Highway Trust Fund, that causes a lot of angst. So I want to talk a little bit about HJR 48 and why it's important. And I want to start with the theory. First, you may have heard of the theory of Pigouvian taxes. So this is the idea that when you take an externality, in this case a pollution unit that is not incorporated into the market, you can essentially impose a tax on that externality, or a subsidy if it's a positive externality. You can impose a tax on that externality such that the market then takes an appropriate interest in it and incorporates it into its calculation of what the efficient output is. This is used in a number of different both theoretical and real-world models of how to control any number of negative externalities. In the case of carbon, if we are to impose a carbon tax, what we would be doing is creating a market-based solution. Let me be clear about that. This is a free market, market-based solution. And I would submit that you are going to hear testimony from a number of people, some of whom purport to be economists, some of whom purport to represent various interests that were opposed to House Bill, if I may bring up another bill, House Bill 2186, and that was a regulatory approach, and that instead we needed a market approach. This is the market approach. Now, again, HJR 48 is not saying whether we should impose the tax or not, or whether that's a better system, or a cap and trade system is better, or a regulatory approach is better. But what it is saying is that from an economic perspective, the Highway Trust Fund limits us in efficiently looking at market-based mechanisms, because it requires the revenue from that Pigouvian tax to go into building roads. And by definition, that's the opposite direction that we want to go to control the externality. The most efficient use of an externality tax is a reinvestment in those things that mitigate the externality. That's how you minimize what we refer to as deadweight loss, the loss to the economy from the imposition of the tax. Again, HJR 48 is not about whether climate change is happening or whether climate change is not happening. It is, and let me submit for the record, climate change is happening. It's happening faster than we ever thought before. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill is about allowing Oregon to efficiently use its public policy options available to it, and that if we choose to go down that route in the future, that we need to have a constitution that allows us to take advantage of market-based mechanisms to control our carbon and transportation future. And it is the first hearing that we have had this session that recognizes that the Highway Trust Fund, as written, is an impediment to both our transportation and our carbon future and the efficient use of Oregon taxpayer dollars. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Representative Bruhn.
Thank you, Mr.
How
Chair.
How should I have guessed?
Just the last couple days.
Please, go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate the testimony. Appreciate you bringing this. I'm having trouble understanding your several-time argument that this is the market-based approach, and sort of drill down to your point, which I think is exaggerate, that to reduce this externality, which in this case is carbon, I would argue that the tax itself does that. What you do with the tax revenues, when you argue that they're market-based, you're not. The market will determine what the next course is if the carbon becomes more expensive via the tax. The market will say, okay, that method, that externality, if you will, is too expensive. That will drive investment, production in other areas. I'm not sure where you get to having that money go into a government-coordinated fund where the government is picking winners and losers of somehow a market-based approach.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruhn, let me first be clear. This resolution does not advocate, and I am not advocating either way, that the revenue from a carbon tax go into a government-operated fund to pick winners and losers. What this resolution does is say that public policy should be able to determine the most efficient way in which those revenues can be used, and that tracking those revenues constitutionally only into building more roads is not the most efficient way to limit our options and how we use that revenue. Now, to get to the larger point about the market forces behind this, you are absolutely correct that the price of the carbon will determine how the market reacts to that. Any tax that you impose, for whatever reason, has a cost to it, to society. One of the things that we do in this committee, as you know better than I do, having served longer in the legislature, is that we make decisions about trade-offs. When we impose a tax, do we get benefits elsewhere that and a larger public good that offsets the results of that taxation? In this case, what we are saying is that we as a legislature should have the ability in this sector to make that decision as well. and that it can be most efficient when you take a tax on an externality to reinvest that in reducing that externality. Again, maybe government's doing that. Maybe there are there's a private sector way to do it. There's a number of different ways to do that. But then that reduces the overall burden of that tax, period, out there in the economy. If you reinvest the revenues from it in reducing the amount of the thing that you're taxed, and you're taxing that thing because you want less of it, then you need less tax to achieve your public policy goal. And at the end of the day, there's less tax burden on society.
Could that be accomplished? I'm not advocating this tax at all, but I think this is an interesting academic discussion. Couldn't that, the last point you made, be better achieved by making a carbon tax like this revenue neutral? So you want to mitigate the externality, you want to reduce carbon, but you don't want to damage industry or people, I think is what I heard you say. Would it be the most efficient use of this than, say, if you are going to impose a carbon tax, we're going to offset that somewhere on a revenue-neutral basis? And I don't know how that – I could come up with 100 ways that could be achieved, but you know what I'm getting at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I'm sorry, I will get this right. Representative Bruin, that is exactly the point. That is exactly the point. That if we create a carbon tax as a state, you nailed it, that we could potentially create a carbon tax that is revenue neutral, where every dollar that comes in goes right back out the door towards helping fund green industries that are going to lower our carbon footprint, that are investing in alternative technologies, that are working on grants back to businesses or homeowners for energy efficiency, or even just go directly back to them, a green kicker, if you want, out of it. But under our Constitution, we can't do that. And that's what this does, is modify the constitutional provision so that we have an option to do a revenue-neutral carbon tax. We couldn't do it now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Call, then Bentz, then Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bailey, this is an important discussion you've begun here today. You and I, having lived through House Bill 2001, A Space Odyssey, I think realize that a lot of the shortcomings of that bill were simply as a result of the limitations on the uses to which highway trust fund dollars could be put. And I'm wondering, I want to try to take you down a few different paths here and see if we can get to the same result of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and doing our part to mitigate global climate change. So what I think is interesting about this resolution is that I feel like there is a good nexus between the Highway Trust Fund discussion and carbon emissions and therefore a carbon tax. I'm wondering if there is maybe a closer nexus that we could draw that would be more palatable to the electorate, but that would get us to the same results. And your economics understanding and your understanding of global climate change, I think, make you darn near an expert able to answer these questions.
Mr. Chair.
I'm wondering, what if we simply expanded the purposes to which we could spend highway trust fund dollars to move beyond roads and say, invest in rail, light rail, high-speed rail, mass transit of all sorts? And for me, the nexus here would be that what we're talking about with a gas tax is the capacity on the roadway. And you and I both understand that there are two ways to get more capacity. You either build more roads or you reduce the number of trips on the highway. And wondering if that result can get us to where we need to be with regards to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. I know it's not as far-reaching as a carbon tax, but expanding the purposes to which this money could be used for, does that get us there or no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I appreciate the opportunity to speak more widely about the Highway Trust Fund. I think, given that we serve on a committee together, you have seen throughout the course of the session that I believe my position has been relatively constant on this or any other issue. I am uncomfortable when we as a body dedicate and constrain our ability to spend the dollars that are raised in certain ways that might limit us from choosing the most efficient way to do it, whether that's with gas taxes or other pricing that we might come up with for the transportation system, or whether it's other taxes that are by definition linked always to another service. I think having flexibility in the public policy process to make a decision about what the most efficient use of those resources are, I think, is very important. That's a general comment. More specifically to the Highway Trust Fund. As we have discussed, it is critical that this state be able to take a look at what the most efficient transportation options are for this state in the future. Now, that may or may not include a consideration of climate change. I happen to believe that if it does not include a consideration of climate change, the other decisions we make won't matter anyway. But regardless of that, we do need to have the ability to make a decision about what the most efficient way to move people and goods are. And that isn't always with roads. It is sometimes with rail. It is sometimes with transit, and that can be rubber tire buses or light rail and fixed rail transit. Those decisions and those discussions need to be had, but they can't under the current limitations. And what this bill does is allow us to have the first step in a conversation that says we need to take a look at the overall system, a comprehensive system, and determine what makes sense for each community. And what makes sense in my community might not make sense in your community and might not make sense in Representative Bent's community or anybody else at this dais. But we need to have the flexibility to make those investments in a way that meet our transportation challenges, that meet our climate challenges, and that preserve our quality of life. And you are exactly right that the limitations that are in place now constrain those conversations.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So, Representative Bailey, I want to be a little bit more specific. I'm wondering, from a global climate change perspective, if we loosen the constraints of the Highway Trust Fund but didn't go so far as to allow for a comprehensive carbon tax and therefore, you know, simply expanded to include transit and other multimodal other modalities to receive funding, does that get us where we need to be with regards to climate change policy, with regards to greenhouse gas emissions? That's, I guess there's three parts to this. Does that get us there? Does this get us there? Your proposal, does that get us where we need to be? I'm trying to figure out what the best way to approach the Highway Trust Fund is.
excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Call, this will be probably a frustratingly weaselly answer, but what I'm going to say is...
Another one?
There is no single strategy. It depends on what your definition of get us there is. There is no single strategy that will solve our climate change problem. It will take a combination of strategies across sectors to solve a problem that is much larger than any one tool can accomplish. That said, in looking specifically at the transportation sector and mitigating the transportation sector's contribution, it still does not by itself get us there. We also need to have comprehensive land use planning. We need to have a way of determining where roads are built and how they're built and what that integration is. But what this does is untie our hands with one respect to meeting those goals. And what HJR 48 recognizes is that there are essentially there are three basic externalities in transportation. There is the wear and tear on the roads, and we do a pretty good job of calculating that and thinking about that. There is the congestion that each additional vehicle causes, and that's essentially a loss in time and the value of time to people that use the roads. And there is pollution. and we have various laws that regulate many kinds of pollution that come from automobiles. There are others as well and sort of larger ripples, but those are sort of the three main ones. Gas tax does a pretty bad job. It's sort of a proxy for some of those, but it doesn't really get at any one of them really well. So where I believe we need to go as a state is to have a system that recognizes and individually addresses those three major externalities, that we have a system that is based on vehicle miles traveled and the weights of the vehicles to account for wear and tear, that we have a system that is correctly pricing the cost of the pollution externalities through carbon taxes or through through other methods. Cap and trade is also a version of a market-based solution. And third, through congestion pricing, and I've been pretty consistent in my support for tolling and congestion pricing. How we use those revenues then to reinvest in the transportation system to make it efficient is really important, and the investments from each one of those methods of funding transportation will call for different kinds of investments depending on the externality from whence it sprang and the user cost. And the way the trust fund is written now, we cannot have an efficient system that accounts for the different kinds of costs that the transportation system imposes on society.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have a number of other questions. Would you mind if I call the legislative counsel, get the information that he can give us, and then go back to the questions?
Mr. Chair, that would be great.
That would be great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And Mr. Chair, would you allow his letter to be distributed?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Thank you.
I haven't seen his letter.
Well,
but I'd like
that's
to.
That's because it hasn't been distributed.
Okay. Sure. It would have been fine with me to have distributed it earlier.
That's what I was trying to get to you to ask.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. What would be extremely helpful, I think, for the committee is to understand what the limitations are on the legislature or the people enacting laws having to do with the use of a carbon tax approach to raising funds to use for something other than the highways, or I think there's a limited place in which they end up in the common school fund in another section of the Constitution. Could you describe briefly what those current rules are and what they limit the expenditures for?
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel. Yes, I'd be happy to talk about at least the highway limitations that exist in the Oregon Constitution at the moment. And basically those requirements are that any tax imposed on the use of motor vehicle fuel, the revenues from that must be used for essentially highway construction, reconstruction, improvement, and maintenance. To be candid, I am unaware of the Common School Fund piece, and I'll have to research that a little.
I think it has to do with the hope that at one time the legislature thought there might be some carbon fuel located in Oregon and that the severance tax would result in funds going to the Common School Fund if they were found on state lands.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that actually, now that you've refreshed my memory, that is correct that there is an oil and gas severance tax limitation somewhere in the Constitution. I'm not exactly sure what it is. But,
thank you.
So, anyways, under the terms of the existing Constitution, motor vehicle fuel taxes must be directed towards highway construction and maintenance, essentially. I'll also note that the Legislative Assembly has a plenary taxing power. In general, it can tax anything that it chooses to do so. There are certain specific limitations, but the general power is one that the Legislative Assembly is free to tax whatever by statute it chooses to do. And that is an important distinction here, because when you start to look at House Joint Resolution 48, which authorizes a tax on carbon emissions, in subsection 1 of that, the important thing to remember is actually that authorization is not necessary for the legislature to enact a carbon-based tax. This is important because of the standards for which the courts employ in Oregon in construing constitutional provisions. Those standards are essentially what, at the first level, what is the plain meaning of the words used, and then second, what is the relevant case law and historical and the historical context of the provision. And that's crucial here because subsection 1 of HJR 48 essentially is unnecessary. So the courts will ask, well, what is the historical circumstance why the people decided to adopt HJR 48 if this, in fact, becomes a part of the Constitution? And they will look at that in the historical context of the limitation on motor vehicle fuels that currently exists, taxes on motor vehicle fuels, and will view this as an exception to that. And that is essentially the short answer here. HJR 48, with respect to carbon emission taxes on motor vehicle fuels, is, in my view, an exception to the current limitation on motor vehicle fuel taxes that requires that they be used for highway construction. So that's
the essence of your letter.
Exactly.
Okay. We've been talking about motor fuel taxes and taxes that are related to motor fuel. The provision, of course, would have much broader application than that, mm-hmm. would it not? And would it establish a limitation then on the use of taxes imposed on the release of carbon emissions from other sources, like, for example, a coal-fired power plant or a tax on barbecue briquettes based on the fact that they emit carbon dioxide, or some other tax on something else that isn't directly related to transportation?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This authorizes a tax on carbon emissions. So in order for all of the provisions here to be applicable, the tax must be structured so that the base of the tax is a particular volume of carbon emissions based on whatever the substance is that is being taxed. So motor vehicle fuel, a gallon of that emits X carbon. A ton of coal will emit Y amount of carbon, and the tax will have to take into account those differences. If you impose a tax on some other basis, then none of this applies, and you would be back into the tax revenues, at least in the motor vehicle fuel piece, being directed to the highway fund.
And for other purposes, to the legislature's plenary power.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Representative Call.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, I appreciate you coming down here today, delving into the Highway Trust Fund and whatnot. I want to get my head around how limiting Article 9, Section 3A, Section 3A is with regards to this discussion. Representative Bailey listed a few other policies that he supports as other tools in the the war against global climate change, or however you want to phrase that, and one of them was congestion pricing. Does congestion pricing follow the same kind of logic that this does? Is there, and if it does, it seems to me that there then is probably no way for us to get at dealing with an emissions problem through taxation. Would that be a safe assumption? I guess there's two questions there. One is whether congestion pricing falls under the limitations of the Highway Trust Fund, and whether or not there's any way to envision a way to deal with the emissions problem through the tax code or through taxation that would not be limited by the Highway Trust Fund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, let me deal with the congestion pricing question first. Congestion pricing, as I understand it, would be some type of scheme where in order to have the permission to use your motor vehicle at certain periods of time or in certain locations, you have to pay some sort of a fee. And I would view that that would be subject to Section 3A, Article 9 of the Constitution as well, because not only does that apply to motor vehicle fuel taxes, but it applies to the use of motor vehicles as well. And that's how I would perceive congestion pricing or whatever the term is. There perhaps would be I wouldn't say that it is impossible to tax carbon to have a tax scheme that facilitates the or incentivizes the reduction in carbon emissions somehow, but none come to mind immediately. Perhaps through some type of income tax credit, that's what, or property tax exemption kind of thing. In other words, where you're creating tax benefits for alternative approaches to particular activities that reduce the level of carbon use. I think that would be okay. That would stay away from highway trust fund issues. But
thank you, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Johnson, perhaps just following up on your question there for a moment, or the question that Representative Call asked, can you address the issue of the tolling then, of the proposed tolling on the bridges that we've been talking about? Is that somehow limited by this article of the Constitution we're talking about? In other words, must that money go to something having to do with roads? If a feature of it is congestion pricing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, off the top of my head, I believe that the answer is that that would be subject. That, too, would be a use of a motor vehicle and would be subject to this limitation. Again, it's off the top of my head, so.
Right. If you were to toll a bridge for the purpose of paying for the bridge, that would comply with the current rules.
That would comply with current rules because that is a highway. Highway construction.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if we were to allocate a portion of that toll to some purpose other than the bridge, paying for schools, doing something that had nothing to do with roads.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I believe that would be a violation of the highway fund. You could use the bridge revenues for other highway purposes, not necessarily just that bridge. But I think you would not be able to use it for schools.
Thank you.
The other issue that I think HJR 48 raises is the possibility that this establishes not only an exception to the highway fund, but also a limitation on the use of taxes on the release of carbon emissions into the air, water, or onto land. Would you read it that way as well, that if the legislature imposed a tax on the carbon emissions, then it would have to be used for the purposes set forth in subsection 2?
Mr. Chair, absolutely, that's correct. This language in subsection 2 is mandatory. If there is a tax, the revenues must be used for these purposes only.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Yes, Representative Bent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. So what you're saying is that this subsection 2 creates a limitation on any type of tax, regardless whether it's on a car.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, it only would apply to taxes on the release of carbon emissions. But this does raise a good point that I wanted to elaborate on a little. You can structure I believe, a tax on carbon emissions so that, for example, if it's on motor vehicle fuel, it's collected at the pump when you acquire the fuel. It just has to be the measure of the tax has to be not the has to be based on the emissions, not on the fuel itself. Now, of course, I think a quantity of fuel will release a set amount of carbon, and therefore you could convert it into a per gallon charge. Alternatively, I suppose you could create a tax that is imposed on the sale of motor vehicles based on certain estimates of the lifetime emission of carbon from that vehicle.
Actually, I was talking about things other than vehicles because this seems fairly broad and it would apply to any number of things other than vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just asking if your reading suggests that no matter what the source of the carbon emission, the money must be used for the purposes reflected in sub 2.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, let's explore the limitations here. If the state enacted a general sales tax that charcoal briquettes were subject to along with everything else, but it was, you know, a tax of X percent of sales, no, I don't think that would be then when you bought your briquettes and there would be carbon emitted as a result of the use of that, that wouldn't be subject to this. It's only if the tax were based on the carbon emitted as a result of burning whatever it is you're talking about.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get that. I wasn't going to a sales tax. I was simply asking if this applies to emitters other than cars.
Oh.
And description.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, yes, this would apply to power plants and other things where carbon is emitted as a result of the operation of the facilities.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking time out of your busy day, and we'll let you get back to other tasks. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, additional questions for Representative Bailey, and Representative Benz was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought you might address for us the thought that if the carbon tax was adopted first and then initiated, whether it would be a better or additional or substitute device for the regulatory issues we've been discussing in other committees this session. For example, 2186, which puts a regulatory methodology in place. Would that be, if this carbon tax device was available, would it take the place or could it take the place of those other regulatory tools? I think you kind of brushed upon that in your opening remarks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that is a fantastic question. It would depend to some degree on the level of the tax and where the revenues from that tax are dedicated. It is possible you could have a hybrid model between regulation and a pricing scheme such that there was a ceiling or a place where regulation kicked in. For various reasons, you could structure it in a number of different ways. But I think the point is very clear that you can't have it both ways. If you believe that climate change is real and happening, you can regulate the transportation sector and carbon emissions, or you can impose a cost on the externality and let the market do it. But if you believe that climate change is happening, you can't say no to both. One of those ways will work. Either government's going to do it or the market's going to do it. And there might be a hybrid in between those things. But this could potentially create allow for a system that is a market-based approach that does obviate the need for regulation.
Actually, my question was directed more toward the difference between a carbon tax on the one hand and cap-and-trade device on the other. One is a much more focused device, and the other, the carbon tax, is not. I was hoping you would address that.
Ooh, now you got me drooling. Okay, so...
You gave him the opening that will allow him to take the rest of the morning.
I don't.
Give us the short answer.
He doesn't get annoyingly weaselly. I do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, in a perfect world with perfect information, if all cost curves are known and all demand curves are known, a carbon tax and a cap and trade system are identical. There is no difference between those two things. The only difference between a cap and trade system and a carbon tax system is which side of the equation is determined by the market and which side is set by public policy. In a carbon tax system, public policy determines the price of the emission, and the market determines how much emission you get for that price. In a cap and trade system, public policy determines how much total emissions we are going to have in society, and the market determines what's the price of those emissions. There is an equilibrium somewhere where those two things are exactly the same. If you knew exactly how the market was going to react to a given price signal, and you knew exactly what the optimum level of pollution that you were trying to achieve is, you could just set the price, and the quantity would be exactly what you would get for that price, or you could set that quantity, and the price would be identical to if you had set the price. Obviously, we don't have that kind of information about the economy, and we don't know which one, where the appropriate price is or the appropriate quantity level is. And so the criteria for choosing between the two are, the acceleration of your marginal, social marginal cost in your day. Anyway, essentially it comes down to where is error going to be more costly? So that's if you have a price and you get the quantity totally wrong because you don't know exactly what's going to happen with that price, how much damage is that extra price going to cause to the economy versus if you set the quantity and you get the price is different than you expect, is the damage that comes from that extra quantity better or worse, much worse or only a little worse than the damage from the extra price? I'm having a hard time describing this. But essentially what it comes down to is if you believe that the costs of what you are trying to regulate are real and are very high, and that it is worth it to risk a little bit of difference in cost of the price of the externality to achieve more certainty on the quantity that's emitted, because that cost is so much more and so much more dangerous, then you want to get your quantity certain and choose a cap and trade system. If you believe that the damage caused by a variation in quantity isn't all that bad because of the externality that you're regulating, and it's more important to get the price exactly right for the economy, then you want to choose carbon tax and choose the price. That's essentially the difference, and I'm sure Mazen will tell me if I'm wrong. So I believe that the costs of climate change are potentially catastrophic. And so that is why I have advocated for a cap-and-trade system. But at a sub-national level, there are arguments for doing a carbon tax versus a cap-and-trade system on administrative levels, and there are other sort of things that go into this, but that's essentially it.
Yes, I had understood on the administrative level that the carbon tax would be a less extensive device and more rapidly deployed, perhaps, than not perhaps, but for sure. Maybe you could address, I'd like to go back to Representative Bruin's question about neutral device. And so if one had a carbon tax in place and then used it to, gave it back to those who are paying it to offset, let's say, income tax, thus driving up the cost of, let's say, fuel, but a net neutral result to the people paying it. This proposal, as it anticipates, actually spending those dollars on other things as opposed to giving them back to the payers and only settling for a reduction in the consumption of the carbon-generating device. But explain why that isn't as good as what is contemplated by this resolution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think that it helps to take a more holistic view of an individual's budget constraints. So there is both the direct income that they receive, as well as the purchases that they make and the costs that they have to them from whether those are costs that are directly incorporated into their budget or not incorporated in their budget. What this says here, well, as a general principle, if you're looking at the transportation sector, there is a rationale, or there was a rationale, for the Highway Trust Fund. And that was a thinking more on the wear and tear side of the equation, and sort of a 20th century thinking about if we're going to tax the transportation sector, it should go towards paying for the transportation sector. And in that context, it meant the thinking was mostly about wear and tear. There was a less of a recognition of pollution externalities and congestion externalities, although some. And there was a thinking that that money should then go back into mitigating wear and tear by maintenance and preservation and building new roads, because that would be what was best overall in aggregate for the individuals looking at their total budget. What this does is updates that thinking and says there's more that we're doing here than just wear and tear, and there's more that goes into transportation than just gas and concrete. And what it does is it says, for example, we are looking at a future where it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen in the auto market, but it is likely that we will have a number of electric vehicles coming online, and that we are seeing a shift towards plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles, and certainly this state has made public policy choices to advance that ball down the field. This says is electricity is now, in some sense, part of the transportation sector, and so that you could use this in mitigating the costs of generating electricity, which is part of the transportation sector. But revenues from congestion pricing should go to relieving congestion, whether by roads or by taking people off the roads. Revenues from wear and tear should go towards addressing wear and tear rather than and that could be maintenance, but it could also be reducing the amount of wear and tear that happens in the first place. Pollution should go towards mitigating pollution. But there are broad ways of doing that, and that if we do that, the total loss to the economy will be less. And by extension, the total loss to the budget of the individual will be minimized. So you could potentially charge a lot of money for an externality and give it back to everybody on their income tax to spend on, toasters and lawnmowers. But that might be one way to do it, but it also might not be the most efficient way to do it to lower the overall tax burden that they're paying in the first place. You could do that if you wanted to have a redistributive aspect to your tax policy. But everything's a trade-off between size of the pie and how that pie is divvied up. And what this allows you to do is to have that conversation about making sure the loss in the size of the pie is minimized. And if you want to divvy it up, we can have that conversation as well. I also want to say for the record that HJR 48, I would be open to tweaks in the language of it. I did not participate in writing it and recognize that there may be refinements that could be made to it. But I think that the point that is made in this resolution is clear. Again, to echo Mr. Johnson, it does not create a carbon tax. It does not create an authority to create a carbon tax that didn't already exist. What HJR 48 simply does is allows Oregon to have flexibility in how it uses those revenues to meet our climate and our transportation future in the way that is most efficient and is best for Oregon taxpayers.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
I'm fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
There's too much economics that I have to talk.
Well, we'll keep it very brief because I'd like to get through our list this morning, if you could.
Just to quickly put things a little bit in distinction, I agree there's different ways of looking at things. But remember, the highway fund taxation system, the way it is doing that taxing structure, it is mimicking a user fee type. So the user is paying a fee for the good that it is getting an immediate satisfaction from. This is not something that is a delayed type of reward. This is an immediate, you're paying for the mile you're driving. The carbon tax is not a good that you're consuming immediately, nor it is probably a good that you will be consuming ever. There's a difference between a public, and this is probably a public good on the same level of a defense, national defense type of public good. It is, everybody feels, gets a public kind of good out of national defense and feeling safe and having enough environment to defend and live in. And this is believing that you could affect, even if you believe that global warming is 100% happening. However, the bridge to it is if you could affect it by doing something, to which level and how much is that public good worth to do it and how effective it could be, that's where you will set the price. Mm-hmm. So the price is a whole different ball game with this discussion. So the parallel is not the same between the taxation that you have on the transportation sector as we have it today designed as a user fee and the public good that is not necessarily determined in price, but it needs to be a policy determination.
Thank you. One other point that I think we have maybe glossed over, but I think is critically important in this resolution, and that is that it appears to be designed, and I believe that I wrote this. I have to tell you, I don't remember for certain, but I believe I did. And if I did, my intention when I wrote it was to establish a system in which there were two things happening at the same time. One was that the carbon emission externality was being charged for. And the second was that systems that would, in their very nature, help reduce the need to use carbon as a fuel would decline as a result of those other systems. So that you get a double bang for it. Part of it is the increasing cost of carbon as a disincentive from using it, and the other is the decreasing cost of other systems that would replace carbon or increase the efficiency of its use so that less was needed in order to accomplish other purposes. You haven't really talked about that side of it very much, or if you did, I missed it. Could you comment on how that feeds into the issue here, if it does?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for glossing over that at the beginning. That's correct, and what we're looking at here is an ability to reduce the magnitude of the impact of the negative cost of carbon on society, as well as reduce the negative impact of the tax on society. And you can do both at the same time by reinvesting those revenues in further mitigating what the tax is intended to achieve.
Right. If I increase the price of electricity by a tax like this, or increase the cost of home heating oil through a tax based on carbon emissions, I can reduce the impact of those increases on the consumer by helping them reduce their unit, the number of units they use.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
And that has societal benefits because it reduces the amount of carbon going into the air, but it also has benefits for the individual because it increases the likelihood that their net costs will either remain the same or decline, as compared to simply imposing the carbon tax and then using the funds for something else.
Mr. Chair, if I may make an imperfect analogy, you can think about pouring water into a bucket with a hole at the bottom. And if you can either try to pour water in faster in the top, or you can simply plug the hole. And if you think of the hole at the bottom as the loss, if you think of the bucket as an individual's budget, and you think of the hole at the bottom and the water coming out as the loss to their budget and their welfare from the costs that they pay directly or indirectly from the damage that the pollution causes to them through climate change, has enormous costs, or through just the paying of the tax and the higher fuel prices that they're paying, you could give all that money directly back to them in some other way, but you're essentially pouring water in the top of the bucket that way. Or you can use that money to further mitigate their need to pay the tax by reducing the carbon content of that fuel and plug that hole that's coming out the bottom.
Or reduce the amount of fuel they need to use.
Exactly.
That would have the same effect. Okay. I think we've belabored this enough, and we'd like to maybe get on to some other witnesses. Thank you very much for your help.
Chair.
And
very enjoyable. Brian.
Thank you. And I have to say that my crude understanding of this issue basically was that if you're going to increase unit costs, you better figure out a way to decrease the number of units people need in order to offset. And of course, the other side of that is we import every bit of our fossil fuel. To the extent we can reduce the importation of fossil fuel, we actually increase the carrying capacity of our economy for other things. Let's go ahead with the testimony. Evan Manvel.
Mr. Chair, he apparently had to step out of the room for a minute.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead with the other testimony then. Craig Campbell, Bob Russell, John Rakowitz. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and this has indeed been a very interesting conversation this morning. I would like to make a couple quick points before I turn it over to one of my colleagues here. What's coming to you right now is the actual history of our State Highway Trust Fund, which was established in 1942. The first attempt to change that provision in the Constitution was actually by the trucking industry when we tried to eliminate the weight mile tax through a constitutional amendment. Then in 1974, 1976, there was attempts to modify the provision to allow for the funding of mass transit. In 1980, the state police and Parks Division, or Department at that time, were removed from the Highway Trust Fund so that those funds could no longer be used for those purposes. In 1990, there was another attempt to allow funding for transit, which all of those failed. Then there was one in 1992 for OSP. Then there was one in 92 for Parks, both failed. Then there was another one in 94 that included both transit and Parks, that failed. 1999, there was an amendment that was actually requested by the Oregon Trucking Associations to embed the theory of cost allocation into the provision. And then in 2000, there was an attempt again to put OSP back into the Highway Trust Fund. That failed. In 2004, manufactured housing was removed from the trust fund, or the revenues from manufactured housing. Prior to that time, you may recall you would see license plates on manufactured homes because they were considered to be vehicles. And in 2004, we changed that, and they're not considered to be homes in their tax under the property tax system. So Oregonians have, for a very long time, liked the Highway Trust Fund, and they certainly have voted to continue to support it. So that's sort of the first point. The second point is you passed on Wednesday off the House floor House Bill 2001, and that had a number of very key provisions that specifically address this issue. You had a congestion pricing pilot in the Portland metropolitan area. We established a system of least cost planning, which would include consideration of carbon output that would allow transportation planners to pick the least cost method of providing the transportation function, whether it be for freight or people. Probably the provision that got the most attention is what we referred to as the MPO provision. What that did is it tied land use with transportation, and it will use the land use planning system to reduce the vehicle miles of travel for light vehicles. And the last and probably least understood of the provisions that are in 2001 is changing the method of cost allocation. Cost allocation is a very esoteric kind of thing, understood by very few folks. Mazin, Craig Campbell, and myself have been involved in the cost allocation studies for at least the last decade, if not more. What that provision does is the current method of cost allocation that we use is we actually allocate expenditures, not costs. So we decide first what we're going to spend on roads, and then we apportion those costs between light vehicles and heavy vehicles. The provision in 2001 suggests that we try a different approach of cost allocation, which we referred to as the efficient fee method, which in fact changes that whole equation so that you are now allocating costs instead of expenditures. Carbon output is a specific cost that is considered in that process. It's one of those externalities, which will, when fully implemented, you will have that market-based efficient pricing system that will charge people based on the true costs that they impose on the system, including carbon output. So with those four provisions, I believe that this bill is unnecessary. The third point is that this is sort of one of those bottom line issues for my association. We will vigorously oppose any attempt to bust the Highway Trust Fund. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, do you want to hear from the whole panel?
I think we should, and then we'll go to questions. We have quite a few people to hear and less than an hour to do it. So I'd like to hear from the panel, and then we'll come back. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Rakowitz. I'm the Public Affairs Director with AGC, Associated General Contractors of Oregon. I'm going to be brief and to the point. I do not have the history on the trust fund or any of the other esoteric elements here, but my organization does have a long history. We've been on the record. I suspect it's no secret. We support the trust fund as it currently exists. We view it as a user fee in the way that was earlier discussed. We believe the long history of the voters, they have spoken repeatedly. We believe there's a nexus in the public's mind. We support that. We are incredibly pleased about the House, and we hope today the Senate's approval of a significant highway infrastructure goes beyond, much beyond highway per se. It's the whole highway infrastructure that investment will make, long needed, overdue investment in our transportation infrastructure. Having said that, it's significant, maybe the largest. There remains a significant documented backlog as it relates to maintenance and transportation infrastructure. So, for that reason, we continue to support and want to go on the record today that the need remains, the nexus is there for in the public's mind, and for that reason, we would oppose this bill as well. I will make one other comment. There's been a lot of discussion this morning about transit. The carrier of the bill before that increased the funding that exists, the funding mechanism for transit in a couple of metropolitan areas. AGC was clearly on the record and visibly supportive of that. So it's not that we do not support other modes of transportation. I think that's important to note. And that's the end of my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA. We're also opposed to House Joint Resolution 48, and I want to explain our reasons for that. There are really two issues that for AAA we have an unswerving policy on. One of them is the one that Mr. Russell mentioned earlier, which is cost responsibility. If any imposition of tax does not adequately reflect the use of the highways by cars and trucks, and the tax matches that use, then we will oppose it. The other one is any effort to what's been referred to as busting the trust. And it's for that reason that we're opposed to House Joint Resolution 48. I want to indicate that that does not mean that some of the goals that are trying to be carried out by HJR 48 are things that we oppose. In fact, we've been working since the end of last session to try and work with the environmental community to try and implement certain things, some of which Mr. Russell indicated in House Bill 2001, some of which, however, have not yet been accomplished. One of them is, as I believe Representative Bailey mentioned, is we have a tax system and gasoline taxes which is inefficient over the long term. Ironically, the reason for that is because we are making vehicles that are less dependent upon fuels, so they are providing less greenhouse gases, and that in turn means we're purchasing less fuel and getting less revenue from it. Yep. So there is a long-term solution that must be derived which will reflect more directly the use of the vehicle on the freeway. The second thing is that as much as we are dedicated to preserving a dedicated highway fund so that our highways are adequately funded and that we can provide assurance to our members that when they pay a tax, that's going to be used for their benefit on the highways, there's an equal need for some form of dedicated fund and for non-highway use. And the most important reason for that is one of the best ways to reduce greenhouse gases is by more efficiently using our highway system so that it better integrates with other modes of transportation. So that when my members get up in the morning and they have to choose how they're going to get to work or the grocery store or whatever else, they have more options available to them so that their primary and best use is not always the automobile. That's going to take, on one side, a dedicated amount of funds so that multi-modes can be an active participant in planning for highway expansion, changes, and the expansion of other modes so that they're integrated. Right now, they really are not integrated very well. So those are my primary comments on HJR 48 and why we're opposed to it. And, of course, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to drill in on some of these arguments a little bit because I heard very little technical discussion about what's actually in the constitutional amendment. So let's start with Mr. Russell. Mr. Russell, it sounds like you had essentially three arguments. One, that the voters have a history of not supporting it, and if I read this correctly, that would appear to support my remarks that the Highway Trust Fund represents 20th century thinking. And is it the case that the only vote in the 21st century has been to bust the trust in some sense? Remove a definition of motor vehicle?
All right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, yes.
Okay, next. I think your second argument was that it's not necessary, and you listed off a number of different revenue-raising measures. I did not hear any comments about the restrictions on how that money is spent, which is what the resolution before you addresses is the most efficient way to spend those revenues. Why is it that the congestion pricing that you referenced, the least cost planning model that you referenced, the different methods of raising money that you referenced should all be spent in the same way? Could you give us the technical explanation for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, you know, there would be no reason other than there's not enough money today. If we had a surplus of revenue in the Highway Trust Fund, then I would agree with your argument. We should bust the trust and spend that surplus on other than highways. But in my experience, we have never had a surplus. So the least cost planning approach will determine the best way of providing the efficient and effective transportation. Then it's a question of funding. We don't have enough money for highways, we don't have enough money for transit, but we can use the transit money, and we had hoped to actually establish a dedicated fund for transit this session, and we're unable to get that done. The only time it would become an issue is if you had a surplus in either one of those funds. As long as you've got a shortfall and you're not adequately funding the system, then I don't think that it matters.
follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I've got a shortfall in my budget by a Lexus, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what I should be buying. If the lease cost planning model that's out there makes a determination about the best way to invest those resources with a mix of different investments, are we or are we not currently constrained from following the advice of that output by the Highway Trust Fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we are not constrained in the from the standpoint that we can build transit or another alternative. We just can't fund it out of the Highway Trust Fund that doesn't have enough money today anyway.
And, Mr. Chair, final follow-up?
Yes, please.
So if we can't fund transit and the most efficient way to do it out of the Highway Trust Fund, explain to me your rationale for advocating additional taxes on Oregonians to fund what should be the least cost way. Your point is that we don't have enough money in the trust fund to build highways. If that is not the least cost way to provide transportation options to Oregonians, why do we continue to pour money into that rather than look at flexibility for the Oregon taxpayer in how we make investments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we just implemented a provision that allows a least cost system of planning to be developed. We don't have that system today.
Why does that preclude this resolution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, nothing precludes this resolution from that standpoint. It's just my point of view that the provisions that we have, the planning provisions, the cost allocation provisions, are a more economically sound method of approaching this issue rather than delegating to the legislature the ability to direct investments from what would be prior to the passage of this dedicated to highways.
Mr. Chair, I would submit for the record that I think this comes down to Mr. Russell's third point, that his organization has a policy against this that is not based in technical fact. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Call.
Yeah. This is an unholy trinity here. No, I shouldn't say that. No, that's not true. I shouldn't lump John and Bob in with you.
Representative Call, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Sorry, Mr.
Please.
Chair. First of all, I'd like to say, Bob, that you actually have been really a great partner in the transportation discussion. The MPO piece, which was very controversial, you were one of the most supportive people in that and understood the value of wedding land use and transportation planning together. So I don't see you, any of you guys, as the enemy on this policy. So I guess what I want to try to get to here just briefly is how we get to yes. So, Bob, first of all, for you, let's say we had enough money. All right, let's be in that hypothetical world. Then would you be willing, would your organization be willing to look at how we plan the transportation system, both a mix of increasing roads or decreasing capacity through investment in transit and rail? Would you be more willing to take a holistic approach and to use the term that's been used here, bust the trust?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, assuming that we had adequate funds, there would be no need for a trust fund.
Okay, so you're saying that we wouldn't need the trust, we wouldn't need the limitations, and your organization would support that?
Assuming that we had adequate funding.
My next question then is, if we, because I think that we've begun a very important dialogue here, and I do think that there are many of us who believe that investment in other modes of transportation and reduction in capacity in the long run is the best way, reduction in use. And
capacity needs?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Reduction in capacity needs can get us a long ways there, and I would hope that we could continue the conversation that we started this session on that point with your organization, because I do think you're much further down this road than many of us thought you all were, and very happy that was the case in our discussions, especially around the MPO language. So good to know that
we may never get to that perfect universe, but at least knowing that there's that this is not so set in stone is very helpful for me. Now, John, with regards to AGC, it seems to me that your perspective on this is kind of a nuts and bolts thing. Your guys build roads.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, we build everything.
That was going to be my next point.
We
you guys build rail,
build
you guys
transit,
build...
transit, we build bridges, we build any kind of infrastructure. That's only one part of our industry, obviously. So we do not get into the business of picking modalities, picking projects, or anything else. That is not... in fact, there's a policy longstanding that we do not get into that. What we do get into, this is a public policy issue for AGC, in my understanding. I've been here 1 year. It is a public policy issue that there is simply, we are playing catch-up in our basic infrastructure. So for us, it's not strictly about the building of whatever projects. It is about the health of the economies of the state of Oregon. And that's why we so strongly support the trust fund as it exists today. We also strongly support, and we're visibly supportive, on transit funding. Different source of revenue dedicated to that purpose. We'll build anything that the legislature on the public side and anything in the private sector, commercial, that people are out there willing to fund. So we don't pick modalities, nor do we pick projects.
And so it's safe to say then that you're and I think overarching on this, the thing that kind of sits above this whole thing is definitely the number of votes that the people have taken with regards to this issue. Yeah. And I think that informs to a great extent some
sure.
of where you all
of
are
course.
Coming from on
of
this.
Course.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, if we continued the dialogue we started today, AGC would be inclined to start to look at this issue more broadly. Am I hearing you correctly?
We're more than willing to engage in this issue. We believe there's a huge dialogue that's been started with the transportation package. It needs to continue. We're at the start of this dialogue, though, and we need to be careful about things like that gigantic backlog that's out there. I'll just diverge for a second. I have a long history as a local and state economic development official, and every single project that every company that tried to grow, every company that tried to locate, and I'm talking across a wide range in small, large communities, there were two issues that mattered to them that made them successful. Did they have the workforce, the trained workforce they needed to produce their product, and did they have the transportation infrastructure necessary for their business to grow or locate in Oregon? So I bring that, and I believe that informs part of AGC. It's a matter of public policy that we want a strong economy. Of course we want to build things. We're in that business. But the economy, the transportation infrastructure package that is moving through this, and hopefully will move through the Senate today in very short order, is a long-term investment in the state of Oregon's economy. So, of course, we're not closed-minded on anything. I will go back. The nexus, and you pointed out, the nexus as a user fee makes sense to us. It would appear repeatedly it also makes sense to the voters.
And I wanted to thank you also for your support of 34A, AGC support of Senate Bill 34,
yes.
A very important piece of legislation to me.
I just would like to add that one of the carriers of the bill pointed out this is a part of the transportation package. We believe that.
Right. And then last
yes, I did.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. Sorry.
And lastly, Mr. Campbell, it seems to me, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me you're saying that as a representative of AAA and therefore a representative of its membership, from your comments, what I took to understand was that AAA believes that their membership has some responsibility with regards to the issues of global climate change and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Not that this necessarily is the way or what's being proposed here is the way, but simply that AAA is at a point where it can say that its membership has some responsibility with regards to global climate change. Would that be an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, it would be easier for us to say that the board believes that. Our members are about as varied as there are members of the public.
Okay.
There are those who probably firmly believe that there is no climate change problem, and just as there are those who firmly believe that they are. And I would imagine that if any of you on the panel here today who have those concerns have a membership card of AAA, then your perspective would be one I would be answering to right now. But as an organization, we do believe that we need to be part of the discussion to try and resolve those issues, yes.
So the board of AAA Oregon, has a belief that they need to be part of the conversation about global climate change, and that there is some responsibility amongst car users for part of that concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, for the purposes of me maintaining my employment long-term with AAA, of course, I need to be very careful about how I answer that question.
I'm not employed with them.
Every indication that I have received is they want me to be a positive and engaged member of the discussions to try and come to resolution about greenhouse gas reductions.
Thank you.
I hope
Thank
that helps.
Mr. Yes. Campbell.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, thank you for your support.
Well, given that, Mr. Chair, maybe I could ask my question again.
I found an old one, too, which I did not throw
Mr.
away.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for those of you who don't have such a card, I am, of course, willing to help you to become a member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is Mr. Manville here now?
He said he answered to AAA members.
I didn't ask him a question, Mr. Chair. I don't have my card.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Evan Manville, representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. This bill is one of the most exciting bills this session. I am not optimistic about its passage, but I certainly think it's a bold step.
I think you have correctly deduced that the purpose of this is to open the conversation, and I am very pleased with the fact that we seem to have done that this morning.
Yes, no, it's been a robust conversation, and I appreciate Representative Bailey as well as the other folks leading us through that. We're in an interesting time in history. For a long time, humans used animals to increase their energy. Then they used water and wind. And in the late 1800s, they started to use fossil fuels. And those had enormous benefits. And just now in this time of history, we're discovering the costs are also enormous of being over-reliant on those fossil fuels. So we're at a time in history where we can choose a clean energy future. And that's especially important because last week, the most comprehensive study, most comprehensive modeling done on climate change by MIT, about to be published in the Journal of Climate, found that climate change could be twice as bad as we previously thought. That we could see an average increase in temperature of 9 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100. Previously, Lord Stern, former chief economist of the World Bank, had found that climate change could cost the world 5 to 20% of its gross domestic product. It has huge economic impacts as well as environmental impacts. It's also a question of energy independence. Last year, Oregonians spent about $9 billion on fossil fuels, and that's money that's being shipped out of this state. The Energy Information Administration, just this last Wednesday, released predictions that oil prices are going to go back up to $110 a barrel by 2015, and looking forward that by 2030, still 40% of our oil is going to come from OPEC. So it's an economic issue, it's an environmental issue, it's a military security and issue, and generals have come out asking us to take action on it. This bill is great because it allows it to do that in an economic, efficient way. Just as we taxed tobacco and turned around and used a lot of that money to fund tobacco cessation programs, this is what this resolution could do. There's a saying that when you want something less of something, you tax it, and that's what this allows us to do, tax it. The other part that it allows us to do is invest in things so we can boldly move to meet the scale of the problem. Climate change is such a huge problem. I believe it's the defining challenge of our generation, as does the president of Mexico, which is an oil-exporting country. He recently said this is the biggest issue they face. So I'm very supportive of the bill. I think it's a great great step forward. Look forward to continuing this conversation as we move forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony very much. Art Crino, Todd Wynn, Jim Welsh. Gentlemen.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, respected Vice Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Art Crino. I'm from Tigard. The handout that I've presented you has an 11-minute DVD on one side. I urge you to watch that. It shows rather conclusively, at least in my opinion, that global warming is, if any, whatever you might call it, is caused by cycles in the solar atmosphere, not carbon dioxide. On the flip side of that document that you have there is a petition that had been signed by 32,000 scientists, 9,000 of them PhDs, pointing out, it's very brief, it points out that we should not implement the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, and secondly, that we need more carbon dioxide, not less. That's particularly for the agricultural industry in Oregon, and in general, there's relationships between carbon dioxide, it's not a pollutant, relationship between that and our economy. I spent my career, I'm an engineer, but I spent my career primarily manufacturing, managing factories. In 1988, I was responsible for a Siemens plant in Portland. We manufactured heavy machinery for the electric utilities. Siemens decided to move the plant to Jackson, Mississippi. Our union, IBEW, and the Chamber of Commerce leaned on me to give them numbers that they could take to the congressional delegation to hopefully influence Siemens and corporate headquarters in Atlanta. So what I came up with, the cost of labor, manufacturing labor, in that factory, and this is typical for heavy machinery factories, 10 to 11%. But if you break down the service portion, you know, here, in other words, including incoming, outgoing freight, electric service, we had large numerically controlled machining centers, electric forklift trucks, we used a lot of electricity. But the service portion of the sales price of our machinery was twice as much as the 10 to 11% of the manufacturing area. So what that says is when a manufacturing job, gets moved out of state, two jobs in the service industry cease to exist. Now, you might find this hard to believe, but the profitability of such plants is typically 7.5% plus or minus before taxes. Now, that low number is one reason why General Electric and Westinghouse went away from manufacturing machinery for electric utilities, and it's not like Intel and Microsoft and so forth. So a bill such as this threatens to impact just the use of energy, because we used a lot of it. And if you start impacting that 7.5% profit, it influences decisions on expanding plants, locating plants, moving out of state. Now, there's one thing coming down the road, and I'll just take a couple of minutes to point out that there's 104 nuclear reactors in the United States. There's the Generation 2. They generate electricity for about 1.72 cents per kilowatt hour. That's significantly less than coal.
I'm sorry, could you say that number one more time?
1.72 cents per kilowatt hour. 20% of the electricity generated in the United States is generated at that rate, sir.
Thank you.
And China, Japan, France are building third-generation reactors. They're far simpler, less costly, easier to operate in 4 years, start to finish. So there's 15 potential nuclear generating reactors in the United States. Westinghouse is building a huge factory in Pittsburgh, several thousand employees, to manufacture reactors again. So Idaho is one of the possible sites for such a reactor. So guess where the manufacturing is going to go to get very low competitive? You know, even gas turbines, General Electric, I mean, Portland General Electric uses 7 cents a kilowatt hour. At the Senate Bill 80 testimony, Portland General Electric and Pacific Power and Light said the way we're headed, especially with Senate Bill 80 cap and trade, our electricity rates are going to go up 75 to 100% within the next few years. So I'd like to urge you to consider this short possible appearance of nuclear energy that's going to suck away our jobs in the manufacturing industry. I want to thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am the Climate Change and Energy Policy Analyst for Cascade Policy Institute. And I'm here to testify against this bill. I believe the bill is entirely unnecessary and misguided. And if the amendment was passed, it would impose significant costs on Oregonians and could potentially tax about everything in the economy, mainly because we are all carbon emitters, even in this room. And also, it will provide zero environmental benefit, as far as I'm concerned. So I have three quick points I want to make. First is to put this a little bit more into perspective. Oregon already has a low carbon footprint, and we're continuing to reduce emissions without a costly carbon tax. Oregon's tied for the second lowest energy-related emissions in the entire United States and well below half the national average. And in transportation and residential emissions, Oregon has one of the lowest emissions per capita, and it's well lower than the national average. I believe we're third or fourth. Also, from 1963 to 2005, about 40 years, the energy intensity of the Oregon economy has declined approximately 91%, a fantastic achievement, and we're continuing to get more energy efficient, which leads to pollution efficiency and greenhouse gas efficiency. Also, Oregon already has adopted the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which is leading to further decreases in carbonization of our electric generation. And the state already has a carbon dioxide standard and offset program for baseload natural gas plants, non-baseload plants that use any type of fossil fuel, and non-generating facilities that emit carbon dioxide. My second point is, because Oregon plays such a minor role in these greenhouse gas emissions in the nation and in the world, any reductions made from implementing a carbon tax isn't going to have any discernible influence on global temperatures whatsoever. If the main goal here is to reduce carbon emissions, to reduce global temperatures, to reduce the impact that global warming could have in the future, then you have to stick with that goal. If reducing carbon emissions here in Oregon doesn't do anything to reduce temperatures, then it's all pain, no gain. Oregon only contributes about 0.7% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the entire United States. If Oregon reduced its emissions to zero immediately and continued this into the future, no fossil fuel plants, no internal combustion engines, no single source at all of carbon dioxide emissions, our reductions would be replaced by foreign growth in 16 days. In fact, the growth in China alone would replace our reductions in 25 days. Okay, now that's a complete cessation. Not even attempting to eliminate a small percentage, which would be replaced in just a few days. The reality is China's opening two new coal power plants a week. And every 3 years, they add the U.S. capacity of coal generation into their generation mix every 3 years. My last point is that global temperatures have been declining for the past few years, since 2002, as you can see on that graph, two different measures of global temperature, despite increases in CO2 concentrations. It's obvious that there's more factors other than greenhouse gas emissions, particularly carbon emissions, that affect global temperatures. Thus, reducing a small amount of human-emitted carbon dioxide emissions in the state of Oregon is a low-leverage policy at best. So I can't support this bill, and I can't support it being an amendment on the Constitution. It's going to impose significant costs on the Oregonians. It's not going to accomplish anything as far as reduced global temperatures is concerned. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Jim Welch here representing the Oregon Taxpayers, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Oregon State Grange.
We would not be supportive of this, and the Taxpayer Association certainly would look at this as just a another tax, looking at the cumulative number that are coming from this session, this going before the people. It would be interesting, though, to see the result and suddenly realize, I think, the connection you heard from the highway users group. The connection that people have to the, certainly to the Highway Trust Fund. And I think that's really important. That's why the bill isn't, in a lot of respects, some of my clients believe it's definitely not needed, that we are certainly taking care of things and trying to fund that trust fund to extend commerce. A lot of my clients are rural clients. You're not going to be able to extract them from their automobiles for a long period of time. Improvements in highways are very important to them for a business transaction. And so they see that we need more highway improvement into the future. And certainly this bill is narrow in just addressing carbon. As you just heard, we agree with Cascade Policy's approach on this, certainly. There are other harmful greenhouse gases. We have been working since the 70s and trying to reduce the air pollution, water pollution, and land pollution. And this bill is way too narrow, certainly in that aspect also. So, Mr. Chair, to make it short and sweet, my list of clients would not be supportive of this.
Thank you, Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Wynn, I really appreciate your acknowledgement of the advances the state has made in confronting climate change, and we are a national leader. I'm curious, and this is actually both a question for you and for Mr. Welsh, have you read the resolution?
Yes, I've read it.
And Mr. Wynn, where in the resolution does this amendment impose a carbon tax on Oregonians?
It's really one step towards doing that. I understand that this bill in specifically does not impose a carbon tax, but what it does is it throws it up for the Oregon voters to vote on it. And I believe that people advocating it or proclaiming that this is going to supposedly reduce global temperatures is just wrong, and it's false. And to tell you the truth, it's kind of fraud as far as that's concerned. It's imposing a tax on Oregonians for no benefit. And so, yes, I understand that this is just a resolution to put this amendment out there, but I believe once it does get out there, I think it will be promoted under the guise of saving the planet.
Mr. Welsh, would you agree that this resolution does not impose a carbon tax on Oregonians?
As it reads, Chair Barnhart and Representative Riley, excuse me, Bailey, this does not impose a carbon tax, as said. But a little note I wrote down under here says perception is a lot of what people would read into this, and they would perceive it as the opportunity in the future, certainly, to impose a carbon tax, and that's how they would view it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Mr. Wynn, are you an economist?
That's right.
And then from follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
From an economic perspective, can you describe what the rationale is for directing any potential carbon tax, whether it is, in your opinion, a valuable or not valuable tool, towards road building?
Chair, Representative Bailey, as far as I'm concerned, I can't really necessarily answer that question, mainly because I don't support a carbon tax.
But I assume you are familiar with the theory of externalities and pricing of externalities. Could you talk a little bit about whether all externalities should be directed towards the same purpose as an economist?
I don't consider carbon dioxide an externality. It's not pollution. It doesn't cause asthma. It doesn't cause respiratory disease. It doesn't cause cancer. It doesn't cause heart disease. It causes no direct ill harm on humans in Oregon or on the planet. So as far as calculating externalities are concerned, if you were going to do something like this, the only way that I could even 1% support it is if it was revenue neutral, so that money does get passed back to Oregonians.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Representative Bailey. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wynn. Are you a scientist?
I'm not a scientist. Are you, Representative Bailey?
Actually, I do have a degree in scientific policy. That's correct.
That's great.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. Mr. Kluding. Thank you for your patience.
Very interesting conversations. Mr. Chair, committee, for the record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. I just want to take a few minutes and just, we have to back up. Oregon has to back up and take a look at actually where we're getting our facts. 2005, 2007, again, this session, DEQ brought forth graphs showing where our emissions are. And again, they've been questioned each session. For example, in their pie graph, transportation 34%, waste 3%, residential 17%, commercial 14%, industrial 25%, and agriculture 14%. I apologize, I will have this information on your desk today. Now let's go over a few facts and figures. When a forest fire gets out of control and burns, it can burn 25 to 40 pounds particle matters produced per ton of wood fuel burnt. Now using the 20 pound average, the Biscuit Fire of 2002 of 500,000 acres with 20 ton of fuel per acre consumed and produced 3 million pounds of particle matter. In 2007, in this state, wildfires scorched 750,000 acres in Oregon, producing an estimated 4.5 million pounds of particle matter. The Environmental Protection Agency states forest fires nationally, now this is the U.S. EPA, between 2000 and 2005, unleashed 562 million tons of carbon. In addition, in 2007, greenhouse gas emissions, principally CO2, from forest fires in Oregon resulted in emissions of 56 teragram. 1 teragram equals 1.1 million tons of emissions, resulting in, if you drove 11.1 million cars all year, that's equal to that amount. 11.1 million cars all year on just one fire. Among other emissions from forest fires are carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, ammonium, volatile organic compounds, formaldehyde, methanol, and airborne lead and mercury. Committee, what I'm asking is to sit down with Oregon Department of Quality, DEQ, sit down with them and ask them why, on all their graphs, they do not even mention forest fire emissions. I think that's where we have to start. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Very enlightening. Questions, Representative Brown.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Bill, I appreciate the testimony. I didn't quite get the comparison, but I think I know where it is. You're saying annually, average annually, the amount of greenhouse gases emitted from forest fires exceeds the industrial and commercial and personal output of similar gases. You're saying that our forest fires far exceed equal to 11 million cars on 24/7. I think if I understand that for 1 year. So I'm assuming that the pollutants, if we're calling them pollutants, that go into the atmosphere from forest fires far exceed the pollutants, if we're calling them pollutants, from automobiles, humans, non-green buildings. Do you have that sort of data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, that's exactly correct.
Okay.
And I was up late last night. I want to get to where you can track this on the website and find out exactly where these facts are coming from. Yes, sir, that is true.
So Bill will love this. So I would think that you would argue that here's a way that we could massively reduce our carbon emission and put a lot of Oregonians back to work if we could get into the woods and take care of dead and dying timber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, committee, we could put thousands of people back to work with a snap of a finger if we had a national forest policy. We could build, I will leave that map with you also of what mills we got left in this state. We could build mills. We could build pellet plants. We could put cogeneration plants out there. We could put plants making biofuels and other compounds, very valuable compounds. When I say putting thousands of people to work, we could do that. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, really. Bill, I really appreciate your testimony today, and I want to tell you that from my perspective, our rural communities and our timber communities will be an integral and vital part of our carbon future. Appreciate you coming forward today.
All right.
Thank you.
Chair. Representative Call.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Bill, you throughout this session have brought in a really fantastic perspective on a whole number of discussions. And I don't know how many more times you're going to be able to come up here and talk with us before the end of session. I don't know what other opportunity would arise, but I just wanted to say that I think everybody here appreciates that you've consistently brought in a perspective that very few people bring to the table in discussing these issues, and I wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you. I would like to note that you have filled out an argument that I made very briefly on the floor in response to a question from Representative Chris Edwards on House Joint Memorial 11, when that measure passed the floor, having to do with the distribution of funds that might result from carbon sequestration on federal land. You've made another really good argument in favor of getting us off the dime on a long ongoing dispute over how to manage our forests, which have led to no management at all. And I appreciate your perspective very much. You've given us another way to get at this, which I think is very important and may actually tip the balance on the argument between those who are seen as exploiters of the forest on the one hand and those who are seen as overly protective on the other, and somehow or another find our way through to getting to healthy forests, which actually can be carbon sinks rather than simply ways of putting a lot more carbon in the air. Thank you. We appreciate that. Anything else? Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 48. Colleagues, I want you to be aware that we are now at post and go time. I don't know right this moment what our calendar for Monday will be. It is possible that we will be looking at House Bill 2180. It's possible that we will be looking at the corporate tax bill or the personal income tax bill, although I suspect those are more likely to come up on Tuesday. Also, look for the possibility of meetings at other times than our normal meeting time now that most other committees have closed. At this point, I can't tell you whether there will be a meeting on Monday morning or not, but I hope to be able to tell you later in the day. So keep your eyes open and watch the postings. Anything else?
We'll let you know Monday morning at 5 a.m. Yeah.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.
Watch the skies, Mr. Chair.
That's what.